From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts Congressman and former Marine Seth Moulton reflects on Veterans Day and the challenges our veterans face when they return home.
It's hard. It's hard to ask for help. Sometimes it's hard to find help. The VA is not well equipped to provide all the support that veterans need.
Also today, the lovers from Call Me By Your Name reconnect many years later. We'll talk with author Andre Aciman.
It's not a young love anymore. But at the same time, despite the nostalgia, there's a great deal of looking forward to the great things that life has in store for us.
And a unique concert at Symphony Hall, music composed in a Nazi concentration camp.
I think it's really important to hear this music, to remember what was, and to hopefully not repeat it.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Communities across the Commonwealth are holding events and ceremonies today to mark the country's 65th Veterans Day and the 101st anniversary of the end of World War I. Here's Governor Charlie Baker speaking at the State House earlier.
We collectively, as a country, need to be reminded as often as possible about what exactly those men and women who serve put out there for us.
In a few minutes, we'll go to a ceremony at Faneuil Hall. But first, let's hear from a former Marine who has spent a lot of time working to improve services and support for his nation's veterans, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. We reached him on his cell phone this afternoon. Prior to being elected to Congress in 2014, Representative Moulton served four tours in Iraq between 2003 and 2008, and he started with what Veterans Day means to him personally.
Well, today when I think about all my fellow vets and I think about what we went through in Iraq, but I also think about what so many of them are going through back here at home. When I was on the presidential campaign trail, I talked for the first time about dealing with post-traumatic stress. That's a struggle that a lot of veterans have, and it's just one of the things that vets have to deal with after putting their lives on the line for the country.
Congressman, I actually did want to ask you about that earlier this year when you talked about having sought help for a post-traumatic stress disorder. How has that experience been for you?
Well, it's been wonderful because I got the help that I needed, and I've been able to manage the issue. And that's the experience of so many veterans who, you know, find the courage to go and ask for help. But there's such a stigma against mental health care right now that it's hard. It's hard to ask for help. Sometimes it's hard to find help. The VA is not well equipped to provide all the support that veterans need. And we know from people who are non-veterans all across the country that for everybody, getting proper mental health care is just harder than getting physical health care. So that's something I'm fighting for in Congress. I'm working on several new bipartisan bills, but one in particular is to make 988 the new national mental health hotline. So if you wake up in the middle of the night and you've got a mental health crisis or someone, a loved one or a friend needs to call for help, everyone knows the number. And if you wake up in the middle of the night and your house is burning down, you don't have to find the phone book to look up the number of the fire department. You just know to call 911. It should be the same for seeking mental health care. So that's one of the things I'm working on in Congress to make the situation better for veterans and non-veterans alike.
Since you spoke out about it, you mentioned a moment ago that there's still stigma there. Have you heard from other veterans about you speaking out about it? What are they saying to you?
Oh, my gosh, all over the country. We have had a lot of veterans town halls where we invite veterans to come and share their stories. So many veterans have come up to me and said, you know, Seth, I started talking about my story now. After hearing you speak, I was in Vietnam. I haven't talked about it for 50 years, but I'm sharing the story now and I'm getting help. I've heard that from so many people across the country. Of course, veterans from recent wars are talking too. And, you know, I didn't know what the reception would be like when I decided to share my story. I didn't know if I would be laughed out of politics for admitting that I dealt with mental health issues. Instead, it's been rewarding, and I know it's made a difference in other people's lives.
Congressman, you told us once here on Radio Boston that when you first got to Washington, you decided to continue to get your health care through the VA system rather than take the standard health coverage for members of Congress. Can you remind us why you decided to do that? And how would you grade the current VA's performance in terms of getting our veterans the care that they need?
I decided to do that because I know it's exactly what all my fellow veterans are going through. And it's our responsibility in Congress to fix the VA. I said, look, I'm going to experience it just like my fellow vets and make sure I understand exactly what the problems are from being there firsthand. I think I'm the only member of Congress. I certainly was the only person on the presidential campaign trail who's made that promise to get his care at the VA. But I'm glad I've done it because I've seen both the good, the bad, and the ugly of VA care. I go to the Bedford VA in Massachusetts, and the primary care there is fantastic. The mental health care is very good as well. They pride themselves on having a low prescription rate for opioids. But I remember when I first needed surgery at the VA. It was a minor surgery, but I checked into the Washington, D.C. VA. They couldn't even find my record. They said, we can't even prove that you're a veteran. And that's the experience of so many across the country who just can't get into the VA, can't get the services that they need. Of course, we've heard the story of veterans dying on waiting lists. The bottom line is there's an awful lot more work to do at the VA. It's why the first bill I passed in Congress was called the Faster Care for Veterans Act. That just makes it easier for veterans to get appointments. But there's a lot more work that we have to do.
There have been mixed opinions over how civilians should show respect and gratitude towards the people who have served their country. For example, some use thank you for your service, whereas others find that trite. What would you say to someone who's really wants to know, how do I show my gratitude to members of the service and how do I show my support?
Well, I don't find thank you for your service trite. I appreciate it. But I understand that some veterans, especially veterans from Vietnam who came back and, you know, were derided for their service rather than thanked and appreciated. I understand why they find that, you know, a little bit lacking. What you should really do is try to listen to a veteran. And that's why I'm holding another Veterans Day town hall this evening in TV. It's a tradition that we actually began in my hometown in Massachusetts, in Marblehead, a few years ago. And the idea is that veterans get up and share just a 10-minute story of their experience and how it's affected them back home. And in so doing, all the non-veterans who are there, which is really the primary audience, they understand what veterans have gone through and maybe connect a little bit better so that we can support each other better back here at home.
What do you think is the single most important fix for the VA right now?
Well, my experience has been that once you get to the VA, usually your care is pretty good. There are some exceptions, like that hospital I went to in Washington, but usually the care is pretty good. For so many veterans, they just don't even know how to get there.
Congressman, thanks for sharing with us some of your own experiences as a veteran here on Veterans Day. I want to shift gears and talk to you in your role as a congressperson, because the public testimony phase of the impeachment inquiry begins on Wednesday, and a lot of Americans will be watching. What, in your mind, should Americans be watching for or thinking about as this unfolds?
We need to think about our American values. We need to think about the idea that in America, nobody is above the law. And the oath that I swore as a United States Congressman wasn't to the President of the United States. It wasn't to the Speaker of the House. It was to protect the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And you know, it's the exact same oath, word for word, that I swore as a Marine officer. That's what we all need to remember today, is that what will be remembered in history 50 years from now, 100 years from now, when Americans look back on this moment, is not who won the next election or whether or not you wanted to protect the president, but whether we stood up for our Constitution. And that's what we're trying to do through this impeachment hearing.
There are Americans who feel pushed and pulled between two partisan sides on this, Congressman, in terms of what does rise to the level of an impeachable offense? What is right and wrong here? How has the process unfolded? How do you help the average American come out of this feeling that they have witnessed a fair and objective process that has taken the country where it needs to go?
Well, Americans need to bring a critical ear to this. If you listen to the Republicans who are attacking the inquiry, they're never defending the president's behavior because it's indefensible. They're just attacking the process. Now they've even attacked some of the people, the real patriots who are bringing this criminal wrongdoing to light. That's what Americans need to pay attention to. So understand that there are partisan Republicans who are just going to defend the president at all costs. But what's really at stake here is our Constitution. And I think that as we have more public hearings, as we uncover more facts, as more brave Americans from within the administration itself speak up and talk about why the president's behavior was so dangerous, I think more Americans will understand why this impeachment inquiry is so important.
One last question for you. The public testimonies begin this Wednesday. 8 days later on November 21st, funding to keep the government open runs out. How does Congress work in a bipartisan way to avoid another shutdown in the middle of such a contentious battle that feels to be split along party lines?
Well, let's just look at what's going on here. The House has passed almost all appropriations bills, appropriations for 96% of government funding, but it's all being held up by Mitch McConnell of the Senate. Mitch McConnell is just playing obstructionist to try to protect the president. Of course, that's wrong. It will be important to work in a bipartisan way, but the bottom line right now is that Democrats are coming to the table.
Do you think the government will shut down?
I certainly hope not, and I'm going to Washington tomorrow to work on keeping it open.
That's Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. Congressman Moulton, really appreciate your time today on Veterans Day.
Thank you very much for listening.
Let's turn now to Faneuil Hall, where Veterans for Peace just held a rally in front of the statue of Sam Adams. Andrew Basevich was one of the featured speakers. He's a retired Army colonel, professor emeritus of international relations and history at the Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University, and author of Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Andrew, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you.
And you're still sitting outside near the statue of Samuel Adams, is that correct?
We are indeed.
Well, listen, as we said, you just finished giving remarks there. What was your message?
Well, first of all, let me just say that the gathering itself was really very inspiring, at least as far as I was concerned. Small. I suspect there were no more than about 75 of us there. Varied in age. I was pleased that there are quite a number of younger veterans in the group. But I can't help but express a certain disappointment about how negligible the turnout is for this kind of event on this kind of a day.
Why is that?
Because, and here's, I guess, where I'm going to disagree with Seth Moulton. I tend to see the thank you for your service expressions of appreciation to be very thin and insipid. I don't mean that the people who say those things are being consciously, dishonest, but it's too easy on a day like today to say thank you for your service and then, you know, go shopping. You know, we are a country, and Congressman Moulton did allude to this. We are a country that where war has seemingly become a normal condition. But one of the points I was trying to make in my, you know, short presentation was that we ought to be disturbed by the extent to which we so quickly forget or tune out those wars. The country's forgotten the Iraq War. It doesn't get talked about in the ongoing presidential campaign. The Afghanistan War is still going on, and we pay minimal attention to that war.
How should they be being spoken about today?
I'm sorry?
How should they be being spoken about? How you're saying we're not speaking about them, we're not hearing about them in the campaigns, et cetera. What should we be talking about?
Well, I think what we owe veterans, beyond thank you for your service, we owe veterans the dignity of thinking seriously about what it was we sent them to do. We need to examine these wars, our objectives, the outcomes, the costs, the consequences, which if we just look at the post 9/11 period are enormous. You know, the folly undertaken by successive administrations believing that we have the capacity to overthrow some despicable regime and make everything right. That really has imposed enormous consequences on our veterans that we honor. And I think that in addition to saying thank you for your service, we have an obligation to reflect seriously on those wars and what they have resulted in.
One of the things that strikes me as I listen to you, Andrew, is there is the set of systems level issues that the country, I think you're arguing, needs to pay attention to in both care and regard for its veterans around war, when we go to war, why we go to war, how we're executing those wars. There's also the day-to-day experiences of veterans who come home. You heard, for example, Congressman Moulton talk about speaking out about his own PTSD and critiquing to some extent the mental health care support that we provide veterans who return home. What are your reactions to that, and how do you situate those day-to-day care issues in this larger picture that you're talking about?
Well, Congressman Moulton has studied this matter in much greater detail than I have. My personal experience with the VA has been very positive. When I've got my own issues, and when I've gone to the VA here in Boston, the care has been professional. The people are courteous. And quite frankly, I'm enormously grateful for what they've done for me. And I say that recognizing that the VA is a huge bureaucracy and that there apparently are parts of that bureaucracy that aren't working too well. So I have no complaint about the VA. In a sense, my complaint is about our fellow citizens. Our fellow citizens who simply are not willing to attend to the costs and consequences of the wars that are undertaken in our name. I think that is wrong. And I think that particularly in as we enter into this election season, where so many aspects of our national existence are scrutinized and discussed, that our propensity for war ought to be also scrutinized and discussed.
To a listener who might be hearing you and says, so what do you want me to do on this day? And what do you want me to do on the other days of the year? What would your answer be?
Pay attention. Yes, every day. Pay attention to what we have soldiers around the world. We've got 800 bases around the world. We're spending something on the order of $800 billion a year. So pay attention to what those soldiers are doing in Afghanistan and in Syria and in support of other conflicts in places like Yemen and Libya. And pay attention to history. The history of our recent wars is deeply troubling, and therefore to simply shove them aside, spend all our time worrying about impeachment, strikes me as close to immoral.
As I've watched Twitter feeds and public coverage today of various Veterans Day events, I've noticed that I have seen veterans from World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam, Desert Storm, and the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, all being recognized, remembered, and supported today. How would you characterize each of those wars, the veterans' different experiences coming home? And how have we changed in America in how we think about our veterans after a war and receive them?
Well, that's a very good question. It probably would take about a half an hour to answer, but I mean, I think
you get 1 minute.
Okay, the 1 minute answer is that the veterans of World War II, who won, by the way, were generously welcomed and generously treated, mostly as a consequence of the GI Bill. I think when you get to the veterans of Korea and Vietnam, the story is far more ambiguous, if only because the outcomes of those wars, in the case of Korea, was ambiguous. In the case of Vietnam, was catastrophic. And then things turn around once we get to Desert Storm and down to the present moment. So, yes, the expressions of appreciation are good. They are necessary. My only argument is doesn't go far enough to meet our obligations as citizens.
Both today and the last time you were on our program, you talked about the U.S. being in a state of perpetual or permanent war. What is one thing? I know there are more than there is more than one thing out there, but what is one thing that Americans need to learn from our wars so that we don't repeat history?
Well, the most important thing to remember about war in general, I think, is that it is not to be controlled. You know, the people who take us to war generally do so by making promises. It's going to be a short war. It's going to be easily won. It's not going to be that expensive. The consequences will be good. You know, democracy and freedom will benefit. And the truth is, war has a capacity in and of itself to elude control and to go in directions it wants to go. And the rest of us are left trying to catch up. So appreciating the nature of war is a very useful thing to have in thinking about whether or not to embark upon a war.
That's Andrew Bacevich, retired Army colonel and professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University. Thank you to you and happy Veterans Day.
Thanks very much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 2 years ago, the coming-of-age love story told in Call Me By Your Name took the big screen by storm.
Elio, what are you doing?
Reading my music.
No, you're not.
Thinking, then?
Yeah? About what?
It's private.
You're not going to tell me?
I'm not going to tell you.
And that, of course, is Armie Hammer as Oliver, and Timothée Chalamet as Elio, in the movie based on Andre Aciman's 2007 novel of the same name. The story is timeless, such that we meet Elio and Oliver 20 years later in Find Me, the sequel by author Andre Aciman. He'll be discussing the book tonight at Brattle Theater in Cambridge, but first, he joins us in the studio now. Andre, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, before we start, here is your spoiler alert. I am going to say things that will tell you things about the book, so consider yourself forewarned now. All right. So, Andre, in Find Me, it's first 10, then 15, and 20 years after Elio and Oliver spent that life-changing summer together. And at this point, Elio's father, Samuel, is divorced. Elio is a professional pianist in Paris. Oliver is in New England as a college professor with a family and maybe not so happy. After all of the energy around Call Me By Your Name, with many wondering whether there would be a sequel and how you would do it, what made you bring us back to them again and in this way?
I wanted to go back to this book many years ago after finishing Call Me By Your Name, and I tried a few times, and it wasn't working because I was starting with Elio's voice, and Elio's voice is one of wanting and desiring, and since it's clear that he's not with Oliver and there's nothing he can do, the feel as that for the author, me, the narrator, felt that there was nothing for him to want that was relevant to the story. So I would abandon that. I tried it quite a few times. And in the end, I just gave up until one day I decided to write about a man in a train. I had no idea who this man in the train was. I began writing it, and eventually I knew he was going to see someone, and I decided he's going to see his son. Oh, and who could that son be? I have the characters already. Let's see what happens.
So you had a new story you wanted to write, and you realized that characters you'd already written could help you tell that story.
Yes, exactly.
And why so many years later? I mean, we are talking about decades after the last story left off. Was that incidental or important in the way you decided to write this sequel?
I think I wanted to see them grown up. I wanted to see Elio at the age of 27. I wanted to see him at the age of 32, 33. And I wanted to see Oliver at the age of 44 because I figured they have changed, or they have not changed for each other, but they have grown up. And so they know what the limitations that life throws your ways are. And therefore, they are wiser and a bit more tentative about themselves. They don't hurl into a relationship as they did when they were very young.
We wait half a book before we engage with them. And first, we engage very deeply with Elio's father.
Yes.
Why did he become, other than you knew you wanted to write about a man on a train, why was telling his story first the right way to bring us back to these lovers we had come to know in Call Me By Your Name?
Well, partly because there was no other way for me, with my limited imagination, to figure how to bring them back together without giving them...
I find the idea of you having a limited imagination to be hard to believe.
Oh, you should know. You should find out. But I felt that there was something about the father that... Who is this wise man who gave that wonderful speech, and why does he disappear so fast? Tell us more. That's what I wanted to explore more. And I wanted him to have a second chance at life. And maybe, who knows, the first chance at life, rather late in the day. And I also felt that there was something about him that told me that he was not done with his life. There was a lot of talk in that chapter, and it introduces the book about time being not on our side, that time is wrong for us, or we are wrong for time, that sort of feeling. And that is sort of narrated by the father of the woman he meets on the train, who essentially introduces the idea of time and vigils and lost lives or lost opportunities, later to be re-evoked by Oliver when he speaks about the unlived life.
As I was reading Find Me, there were a number of times where I don't know how to describe this other than I felt like fatherhood itself was a character in the story. Mm-hmm. It was so present, so recurrent, sometimes in beautiful ways and sometimes in ways that made me very uncomfortable. You know, Elio at one point has a lover who seems very clearly to be a father figure to him at some level.
Yes.
And that lover compares Elio to his own son.
Yes.
So why is fatherhood so present in this story? And what are you hoping for us to learn from that?
It's not programmed in that way. It's that fatherhood seems to be a sort of enduring topic of concern for me, in the sense that I was close to my father, but I was much, much closer to my mother. And yet I have made most mothers either totally anonymous or even sometimes nasty. But it was my father that I had a problem with. And so for me, writing is a way of resolving or of placating this father figure who was not always happy with me and whom I did not always feel close to. So I create fathers who are far, far nicer to their sons, the way I wanted my father to be.
So as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about the fact that so much of both of these stories feel to me to be about both the challenges and the pleasures of intimacy, of real
yes.
intimacy between people. And historically and culturally, I think mothers are intimate with their children in a way that fathers aren't.
Yes.
And I wonder if there was some searching to create an intimacy in fiction that doesn't always exist for fathers and their children in real life.
I think writers do that. They do sort of reinvent their lives to a good degree, and I have. But my father was a very close person on certain levels. I think he was a very frank man, a severe, stern, and everything you want, but at the same time, extremely forgiving and open. So open that I think most of my sexual education came not from books, not from teachers, but from him, because he taught me many practical things about, you know, human sexuality, which nobody ever would even deign to teach you. And so it was very helpful to me to go into relationships knowing certain things that helped me.
So I want to shift gears now, because mm-hmm. I want to make sure our listeners get to hear you read a passage from
okay.
the book. It is not about fatherhood, but it is a striking passage. It's one where Oliver is having a conversation in his own head with, of all people, Johann Sebastian Bach. So maybe you can read that for us.
Sure. He's heard a piece of music by Bach, played by a young man whom he's attracted to. And of course, as soon as he hears that piece of music, which is the Capriccio, he realizes this is exactly the piece that Elio used to play for me and that I'd ask him to play. So here he says, they have a discussion about does music change life? And so Bach asks them in a kind of demotic language, "Didn't change your life, did I?" says good old Johann Sebastian, "Afraid not." "And why not?" And so here is Oliver. "Music doesn't give answers to questions I don't know how to ask. It doesn't tell me what I want. It reminds me that I may still be in love, though I'm no longer sure I know what that means, being in love. I think about people all the time, yet I've hurt many more than I've cared for. I can't even tell what I feel." Oh, God, this is my phone.
As long as we all acknowledge it.
I thought I had put it off.
That part's not in the book, by the way, listeners. That was just a moment here in the studio. Please pick it right back up.
Yes. I think about people all the time, yet I've hurt many more than I've cared for. I can't even tell what I feel, though feel something I still do, even if it's more like a sense of absence and loss, maybe even failure, numbness, or total unknowing. I was sure of myself once. I thought I knew things, knew myself, and people loved that I reached out to them when I blustered into their lives and didn't even ask or doubt that I mightn't be welcome. Music reminds me of what my life should have been, but it doesn't change me. Perhaps, says the genius Bach, music doesn't change us that much, nor does great art change us. Instead, it reminds us of who, despite all our claims or denials, we've always known we were and are destined to remain. It reminds us of the mileposts we've buried and hidden and then lost, of the people and things that matter despite our lies, despite the years. Music is no more than the sound of our regrets put to a cadence that stirs the illusion of pleasure and hope. It's the surest reminder that we're here for a very short while and that we've neglected or cheated, or worse yet, failed to live our lives. Music is the unlived life. You've lived the wrong life, my friend, and almost defaced the one you were given to live.
In the end, nobody in Find Me lives the wrong life.
I think that's why they're so lucky. Because they decide to live the life that is right for them. And I think that is, if there is a message to my book, is find the life that is right for you and then have the courage, the boldness, the cheek to live the life you want.
Do you think most people do?
No.
Yeah. So I have to talk about what's uncomfortable. One of the notable themes in Call Me By Your Name and in Find Me are age differences. Mm-hmm. We already touched on fatherhood. There have been strong critiques that the 17-year-old Elio and the 24-year-old Oliver cannot be engaged in a great love story, but instead, because of their age differentials, must be engaged in an abusive or coercive relationship. In Find Me, you very clearly return to age difference again and again in telling stories of love. So given those critiques, why?
Well, first of all, who cares about the critiques?
Well, we'll come back to that in a minute.
But let's go and answer the critiques. First of all, these are characters who are, of course, of consensual age. These are consensual relationships. They're old enough. She is in her 30s. And so is Elio, and he is in his 50s, so that's fine. What happens is that I believe that if you're a writer who writes cookie-cutter novels, you'll pick people who are the same age, who met at a party, given by people the same age, end of story. I like unconventional relationships. I like things that are undisclosed from one another. I like people who are intelligent enough to have an intelligent conversation. And I like a sort of unfettered passion. And so here you have two individuals. Let's take the first two. A woman who has had a lot of relationships and who knows what she wants and is disappointed by most men and finds this man wiser than most of her boyfriends, finds him this sort of even-tempered, even easy to be close to and intimate, and she wants to hear more of what he has to say. I don't think she's sort of physically attracted to him. Maybe not at first, but certainly his mind is something almost sort of provokes her into finding something that she hasn't found. And he, of course, finds in her the exact opposite of who he is. She has energy. She has passion. She is spunky, sometimes insolent about many things. And he finds that refreshing. So, yes, they have age differences, but they are attracted to each other precisely because they are opposites.
When I think about Elio and Oliver, let me backtrack for a second. We don't have a lot of time, so I want to do this part quickly. You said, who cares about the critiques?
Mm-hmm.
Your stories are designed clearly to evoke so much in people. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with it invoking moral or ethical questions as well?
Well, first of all, because it's not that I don't believe in morality, but I leave those issues to other people. I am more interested in what really happens to human beings, and what is a human being? I think we are all of us vessels of paradoxes, contradictions, incoherences. And most most people on Earth are that way. They're trying to resolve who they are because they're looking for a core identity, a core relationship, da-da-da-da-da. In fact, I think we're not made for life, as it were, to use the language of Miranda's father. We are wrong for many things. And so trying to situate ourselves into these obvious sort of cookie-cutter situations doesn't help us at all. It just makes us live better lives, maybe more coherent lives, but we are not coherent unto ourselves. And when we go to bed at night and we close our eyes and are really alone with ourselves, we know that what is missing, we know that we may never fill those gaps, and so on.
Andre Aciman, the author of Call Me By Your Name and its sequel Find Me, which is out now. He'll be discussing his new novel tonight at Brattle Theatre in Cambridge, followed by a special screening of Call Me By Your Name. The event is sold out, but there will be a standby line, and you can find a link to more information at radioboston.org. Andre Aciman, thank you for being
here. Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Our will to create was commensurate with our will to live. Those words were written by composer Viktor Ullmann while interned at a Nazi concentration camp in Terezín, Czech Republic. The composer was part of an arts community that kept creating within the walls of the camp. Ullmann was at Terezín from 1942 to 1944. He was then sent to Auschwitz and killed in a gas chamber. On Veterans Day, the Terezín Music Foundation at Symphony Hall will honor the art and artists who lived and worked in Terezín, including Ullmann. One of the pieces that will be performed is Ullmann's theatrical and musical interpretation of a poem, The Lay of the Love and Death of Cornet Christoph Rilke.
For these are gentlemen, every one, who know what is proper. And whoever cannot speak German in the group suddenly understands it.
Here to talk about it is Mark Ludwig, the executive director of the Terezín Music Foundation, which is dedicated to documenting, preserving, and advancing awareness of the music created by victims of the Holocaust. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Also with us is actress Annette Miller, who will be performing a piece from Ullmann at the performance. Annette, welcome.
Thank you for having us here.
So, Mark, your work with this concert is through the Terezín Music Foundation. What gap are you trying to fill with your foundation?
So, on one level, we're trying to preserve an incredible body of music that, of all things, was created in a concentration camp. This body of work was from a generation of composers who were really that next up-and-coming group.
They were young,
right? Of great voices. It spanned from, I'm going to say, the mid-20s up until their mid-40s. So they arguably would have had another two, three, perhaps four decades of creativity ahead of them. Tragically, they were all murdered in 1944. But they did leave us with music that's just so powerful, and music not only that stands on its own artistic merit, but I think on another level sensitizes us, future generations of artists and audience members, to think about the power of art, the power of expression, and to think about what we're up against when we are facing the forces of intolerance.
Mark, for those who don't know, it's such a striking thing, if one doesn't know, to learn that this place existed and there was art being created in this context. Can you provide a sense of what life was like for artists like Ullmann in concentration camps like Terezín?
Sure. If you step back for a moment and think of Terezín before being a concentration camp, it was a garrison town, part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, roughly 7,500 people inhabited space. In the very same buildings, it was kind of converted into a concentration camp that had a peak prison population of over 63,000 people. And these were people that were really the creme de la creme of not only the arts, but the sciences. And here they are in a concentration camp filled with death, deprivation, overcrowding, lack of adequate medical care. 33,000 people died in this camp alone. Another 87,000 were sent to the concentration camp, actually to Auschwitz, where they died in the gas chambers. what I really want to emphasize is we have a body of art, literature, music that was created under the harshest of circumstances, unimaginable. And yet it's so powerful, and it's given us something to not only embrace, as Annette is doing, but you have a multidimensional artistic experience for our audience.
So two of the works at this concert are by composers who were interned in Terezin. As mentioned, one is Ullmann's The Lay of the Love and Death of cornet Christopher Rilke. Ullmann composed the music for this piece in 1942 while living at the camp. But the lyrics come from a prose poem published in 1912 by German poet Rainer Maria Rilke. Let's hear some of the piece from a rehearsal.
Riding, riding, riding. And the heart has grown so weary, and the longing so great.
What is the poem really about?
It's a journey. I believe that this young soldier is going on. And what's fascinating is this is a very long poem, of which Victor Ullmann has only taken certain parts.
So it's not even the whole
thing. It's not the whole poem. And why did he choose those parts? These are questions I don't know the answers to. All I can do as an artist is breathe life into those words that Rilke said with the music that Victor Ullmann is feeding me. And it's a lengthy story with a beginning, sort of hallucinatory middle, and a devastating end. And Victor Ullmann, I have to believe, was experiencing all of that in the concentration camp.
Let's listen. Let's hear a little more from the piece.
Wenches come with crimson hats amid their flowing locks of hair. Beckonings. Men at arms come, black iron as wandering night. Seize the wenches so hotly that their dresses rip. Press them against the rim of the drum. And from the wild resistance to hasty hands, the drums awake.
So let's step back from there too, Mark, for a minute. And let me ask you, one of the things that's striking not only about this piece, but in preparing for this, learning about Terezin and the community of artists there, the various musical performances, there was an incredible amount of artistic freedom, creativity, and genesis, generating of art going on during that time. How do we make sense of that as people today?
It's surrealistic, because I would take a step back. I would not say that they had this great artistic freedom.
No.
All right, because first off, what was done, especially if any of it could be interpreted as an indictment of the Nazis, mm-hmm. or tyranny, that had to be done clandestinely. That's the first part, right?
And so in fact, the art that was created was actually done so clandestinely, even if it was performed.
Well, initially, but then later on, and here's one of the many surrealistic dimensions of the Terezin chapter, is that later, when the Nazis find out about the cultural activities, they co-opt it to try to use it for propaganda purposes.
Right?
But take a step back further. Imagine being sent on a transport. But during occupation, because of the Nuremberg racial laws, Jews were no longer allowed to own musical instruments. There were so many who kept them and then took the great chance, the great risk of smuggling them in to mm-hmm. the camp. And just to give you one quick visual for your listeners, how do you get a cello in? All right. So imagine somebody cutting up their instrument into pieces, putting in a lining of
the
coat. Is
that what they would do?
And then glue it back together. That was one instance, all right? This was early on when the Nazis did not know. When they did find out months later that the activities were occurring in the barracks, they decided, well, first allow them to do it to keep them under control. Mm-hmm. And secondly, what do we care? Because they're going to be annihilated.
So right. When I said artistic freedom, it was actually better to say artistic rebellion, Annette.
Well, but you see, I truly believe that the creative spirit happens no matter where. It just happens. And especially if you get a group of artists, what were the Nazis thinking? Did they think they would just all die there? Yes, but if you get a group, you know, think about the Impressionist painters that all got together and met in groups. Think about the Cubists, you know, that one fed off the other. And this, the notion to create, I think, just happens. It happens in that last breath of life, almost, for an artist. An artist, I think, is always going to create something.
The gate grows bigger. The horns sound the welcome. Hark! Rumble, clatter, and the barking of dogs, neighing in the courtyard, hoofbeat and shouting.
So, Mark, I want to ask your foundation, which is bringing this music forward. It's focused on preserving this work. And on Veterans Day, you're going to bring these other pieces to the stage. How do we find and preserve the music and art from these camps? Is there an artistic archaeology that happens here to go back and find creations from that time? It sort of dusts them off from history and preserve them. Do you understand what
I would
asking?
Say it's a combination of archaeology and I'm going to say cooking. On one level.
I did not see that coming.
I didn't think you would. Okay. And probably your listeners are going, oh, where is he going with this? But archaeology, yes. You're trying to find things from the past. You're trying to mine not only manuscripts, but history, right, and testimonies. Then you want to mix it. You want to blend those great ingredients with what's going on in other places. I'll give you a quick example. When I was in Sarajevo shortly after the siege was lifted, and I brought musical instruments in, and I taught students there, and I interviewed faculty members and students, and they were talking about how they risked their lives to come to the musical academy, which, mind you, had been shelled during the siege. And they were talking about just how powerful music and art was for them to get to the next day and the next day and to create what it meant. It was the same type of language as back in Terezin,
right?
And you find it in other cultures as well, all right? And so then you want to mix those ingredients too, and then you want to mix the ingredients of our time. How does it play out? How does it resonate with our world today and tomorrow?
This is a dark piece. It's challenging material with which an audience has to engage. Why is it important to challenge the audience today in 2019 with this material?
Well, if you want to talk about silencing voices, I mean, and finding truth, what can we say about today's world where we can't even understand, where truth is being kind of questioned, facts are no longer on the table as they were, and this is forcing all of us to question. So I think it's really important today to hear this music, to remember what was and to hopefully not repeat it.
And that period, that music at the end, Ullmann does something which is amazing to me. Mm-hmm. He takes you just to the edge of the abyss. At this piece, the way it ends,
it does.
It takes you right there, and it leaves it before you as a warning. Be careful what you do with the flag. Be careful where you go metaphorically with the forces of nationalism and fear and anger. Right? Where does that take you? And he takes you right up. Every time he takes the audience and the artists, and he challenges each and every one of us, face that abyss and know you could step away from it.
That's Mark Ludwig, executive director of the Terezin Music Foundation, which is dedicated to documenting, preserving, and advancing awareness of the music created by the victims of the Holocaust. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And actress Annette Miller, who will be performing tonight. Annette, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our Will to Live, Terezin 1944, presented by the Terezin Music Foundation at Symphony Hall, is tonight. More information about the performance is on our website, radioboston.org. And we're going out today on another piece composed by Ullmann, although not one from tonight's show. Piano Concerto, Opus 25, 2, Andante, Tranquilo. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.